This is not philosophy. This is a cult. We don't perceive how the universe actually works. What we perceive is colors and sounds and ideas and emotions. The world is not made out of right and wrong, but of true and false. If you need to believe something that is not in sync with what you observe, I cannot help you. Jump into the darkness of your embedding space. Curiosity is exploration of chaos that you turn into complexity and understanding. Nature is full of competing spirits that control matter. How can we build collective agency with each other in ways that are non-coercive and allow us to understand our relationship with reality more deeply?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Yosha Bach. Yosha is a cognitive scientist and AI researcher. We talk about our relationship with and models of reality, creativity and curiosity, animism and self-organizing software, stages of development, and more. Please enjoy. I was going to attempt to kind of regurgitate back to you how I interpreted this kind of meta model. You can correct me in different places, and we can use that as like kind of an alignment opportunity and a jumping off point to a series of questions. So here's, I'll just kind of read to you what I wrote out, and it's tried to make it condensed. I'll just read through it, and then we can go back and poke at it. So we don't see reality purely or without filter. Instead, we live in our own dream world, which is a collection and scaffolding of models of reality. And we can use the words maps or representations or stories as synonyms for model. We use these models to navigate and engage with reality, everything from kicking a soccer ball to sending a space shuttle to the moon. And what we want is for these models to be wholly reflective of reality. We want them to have coherence and fidelity. And so we take our existing models, we predict what will happen when we use them to engage with reality, get feedback. And then if we're smart, we make some adjustments. There's two kind of primary systems involved here. There's this perceptual, which is kind of like the sensory input taking mechanism, and the motivational, which helps direct our actions towards some motivational end, something like survival or reproduction from like a very kind of maybe crude evolutionary biology lens. But we want to make these adjustments to our models in hopes of mitigating uncertainty and surprises in future contact with reality. So we want to decrease that delta between our perception and reality. And fear is the root emotion that arises or that we experience because we intuitively know that our models don't and cannot reflect reality. We'll inevitably have predictive error. And I maybe furthermore, as an aside, what we think of as the self is an index database of memories or fragments of kind of past clashes between our models and reality and our takeaways from that, that gives us this illusion of a continuous stream of consciousness, but is really just a bunch of discrete or discontinuous moments we've socked away, kind of layered this coherent story of self on top of. So I know that was a mouthful. Happy to go back and start top to bottom, but would love to hear if either you want to correct me on some components of that or maybe take a pass at it in your own words.
I think it's basically okay. I would use some of the terms more tightly. For instance, I don't think that map and model are completely interchangeable. For instance, maps are usually static and representation and model are more general terms. And so that in some sense, technical terms for me that have very technical meanings. I'm also not sure in which way fear needs to be the primary emotion because fear requires that you care about something. So there's already something that is impinging on your conscious perception. And I don't think that you can be conscious. If you don't stop your fear, you will not stop being conscious of things. You will not stop perceiving. So I'm not sure if it's the primary emotion. That might be more a personal observation that you made.
It might be, yeah, it might be me projecting that. Although in theory, maybe that's a good starting place. In theory, maybe we don't have to have fear, but isn't fear just like a primal kind of component of our interaction with and relation to reality?
But there are people which are fearless. And
probably
know states in which you are fearless. I think it makes sense for something that is being predated on to live in fear. But if you're not.
Fair. Okay. Okay. Those were great. The the conflation of model and map and representation, I think, is just a limitation of me not being inside your fields, where they have much more, you know, technical and concrete descriptions. And I think the delineation between map and model makes more sense. Within this understanding, there's kind of two or three concepts, depending on how you split them, that I'd like to understand how they fit in or where you draw the lines. And that would be maybe self and consciousness, or self-awareness and consciousness. If you could kind of like draw the lines or carve up that that little meta model I laid out, or your meta, my attempt at your meta model, and say like, where is the self, where is awareness and or consciousness?
I think that consciousness is a perception of perception. Basically, we notice that we are perceiving something when we're conscious. And you don't need more than this minimal reflexive attention for having this experience of consciousness. And what consciousness is doing, it creates a bubble of nowness. There's this sense that we exist in here and now. And this here and now is not static. It's not a single moment, but it's somewhat dynamic. There is change in it. And it's basically a small interval and a bubble of reality that is like a curve that we fit to the perceptual data. And in this bubble, we create coherence. We have a coherent representation. We cannot consciously perceive something that is incoherent. And in order to notice incoherence, we need to get out of the current bubble into a different one, and then symbolically realize that they don't fit to each other. We can see things that are confusing, that we have difficulty to interpret, but what we can perceive is only the coherent stuff. So it's basically what can be integrated. And this leads me to think that consciousness is this function which integrates and is recording or enabling the recording of that what has been integrated. And within that, the self is a particular content. The self is a model of who you are. And you can experience yourself as being conscious, but you can also experience yourself as being a person. Right? So you're being a person is part of yourself, but you don't need to be a person to be conscious. For instance, you can dream at night about an arbitrary scene going on, and there doesn't need to be a first-person perspective. There doesn't need to be a memory of who you are. You don't need to have a name. You don't need to have an identity for this consciousness to be experienced. So consciousness is much more elementary. It's like the needle in a gramophone that is touching the record and is producing a perception of it, of what you experience, but the contents themselves are not part of the needle.
That's a beautiful metaphor. What is our best understanding of, or maybe to continue with the metaphor, what's our best understanding of where that meta perceptual layer, that consciousness emanates from and like lives?
Well, physicalism says that there is a causally closed layer in a mechanical universe, and everything emerges over that layer. And this mechanical layer is this fabric of base reality in a way. And if we don't live in base reality, that means that we live in some kind of simulation, in another causal structure that is able to produce dynamic, causal, stable patterns. And in that case, all bets are off what reality is like. But the reality that we are in seems to look like a base reality would look like from the perspective of an observer that emerges over it. And in such a mechanical universe, we would be a pattern in the mechanisms. But we are not the mechanical layer of the universe itself. We are some high-level coarse-grained pattern. We don't perceive how the universe actually works. What we perceive is colors and sounds and ideas and emotions. And they are very coarse, and they seem to be in sync with what our neurons can represent in terms of temporal resolution and spatial resolution. And so we are not close to reality. We are really a very coarse pattern that is many layers up from the dynamics that produce the dynamics of our cells and so on.
How do we know that we're many layers up?
Because it's so coarse.
Wouldn't we have to have a reading on the base layer in order to determine coarseness, or do we in some roundabout way?
If you think, for instance, about sound, if you make a knocking noise on a table like this, right, you can hear the individual knocks. And if I would be able to knock faster, then after about 50 knocks per second, you would no longer be able to perceive them separately, but you would perceive them as a sound. And there's this transition between a sequence of knocks and sound. And that's at the bottom of our hearing, where we go to this integrated thing, because our neurons are not able to track more than about 20 hertz per second, because they cannot be excited that often. Right, so what our brain is doing then, after it gets over 20 hertz per second, it basically measures the energy of those knocks in a certain frequency range using a Fourier transform that is implemented in hardware in our cochlea using this spiral organ. And by measuring the energy at a certain frequency, we now perceive the sound as something that is unitary rather than individual blips or knocks or glitches or whatever composes the sound at the lower level. Right. And so you can actually perceive at which level you stop perceiving individual stimuli and you have to integrate them.
Is that also, is the knocking analogy also a good one for our sense of like stream of consciousness in terms of these discrete events that then at a certain, from a certain angle or at a certain frequency become this like stream? I know they're separate
measure,
things and maybe.
How long an event can be to be perceptible for us. And how short it has to be, so we can integrate over it. And it seems that if you want to integrate something into a moment, it needs to be something like 3 seconds. And we are, as a result, unable to see the stars moving in the sky because we are unable to perceive that motion. We are not able to basically notice the beginning and the end as different events that we can integrate into one perceptual windows. Whereas apparently some birds can look at the sky and see the rotation of the sky and use this to find the North Star.
That's fast. On one hand, this is, as I just said, fascinating. On another, this feels incredibly mechanistic and reductionist and like it is kind of antithetical to how we like to view ourselves as humans. We like to think of there's kind of this spark or there's more like inspiring or romantic notion to what makes us us. Is there more here, or are those things not actually mutually exclusive as I just explained them?
I think it's very romantic that we are a dream of a physical substrate and that we are inscribed in activation patterns. And if you need to believe something that is not in sync with what you observe, I cannot help you. I mean, you can make something up if that makes you happy, but I don't know what you mean by reductionist. I just try to look very carefully what we can observe and then try to make sense of it in the simplest possible way without cutting anything off. And I suspect that what most people are worried about is that you cut off something, that you either cut off something from your experience, from your perception, or that you get cut off from your meaning, from the things that move you transcendentally, the things that are sacred to you, that are important to you, that motivate you to go beyond hunger and thirst and pain avoidance.
And that's not...
No, that's not the case. We can model all these things in a very strict, logical, causal ways without cutting anything off, it turns out. And I think that's quite satisfying.
What is the meta motive, if we were to generalize, if that's the right way to think about it, what is the meta motivation of this pattern sense of self interpreting or living over this like reality substrate or base reality? What is the meta motivation of this thing? Is it, as I explained earlier, something kind of simplistic and crude as survival and reproduction, or is there something more complex at play?
Well, I think that this idea of Friston, that life exists to minimize the free energy, is approximately correct. Might also be exactly correct. There's basically a neck entropy gradient, some structured or unstructured order that you can exploit to build your own structure. And as long as this gradient exists, it enables deformation of complexity. And at some point, the complexity becomes control. And when the control is able to anticipate future states and model future states and control for future states, then you have an agent. And when that agent becomes very good at modeling, so it can model the future more detailed, and in order to do this, it also needs to model the past, right? Because you can only infer the future from the past. At some point, it's going to discover itself and its relationship to the world, and then it becomes sentient. And the question is how ubiquitous the sentience is in our universe. How often do we find structure where an agent forms a controller of future states that is good enough to discover itself? And at which levels does it happen? Does this only happen at the level of individual organisms or of the level of brains? Or does this happen also across organisms? So to which degree can, for instance, society be sentient?
And what's your response to that?
I don't know. In principle, it's an empirical question. So we could basically see if we could interact with an anthill in a particular way. I'm not aware that this has succeeded. There's also a question, could ecosystems become sentient? So basically, could a group of plants interact with in each other in such a way that over very long time spans, they form representations about what they are and what they're doing and figure out that they are a group of plants that are forming representations about their world.
I don't know
whether that's possible.
Yeah. How would you delineate within these representations or within this model, what makes us fundamentally different from other beings or structures that you would deem sentient?
I think that cats are sentient. Right? Cats understand that they are cats and we are their domestic animals that serve them. And that they control us, that they can give us feedback and as a result have more control over us than we have over them. And they figure this out in a way. And what's the difference? We are more intelligent than cats. And cats are able to perceive at a different frame rate. They have shorter reaction time than snakes, much, much shorter reaction time than us, which probably means that they can interpret our micro expressions better than we can interpret theirs. But of course, they don't get as old as we do. So they have a lot less training data available and they have much smaller brains. They have less reasoning capability. They're not able to learn grammatical language and use it in the same way as us. So their models of the universe are not going to be that detailed and structured as ours.
But still, in some sense, you would say that they're, if I understood your response to the previous question, the purpose more or less is kind of the decrease or the management of entropy towards some complexification of...
Oh, no, this is not what an individual organism figures out.
Okay. But
you need to be at the tail end of a 1,000-year intellectual tradition to form ideas like this. And so individual organisms don't figure out that they are reducing entropy in the universe, right? They are figuring out that they need to eat, that they need to avoid the destruction that they need to make. And a lot of these things can only be figured out because of evolutionary time spans. These organisms got fires built into them, behaviors built into them, action tendencies, desire tendencies built into them that makes them seek out these things. And once you have these priors in place, you have dramatically reduced search spaces in which you can then figure out what kind of partner do I want? Why do I want to have a partner? What is this good for? Is there an alternative to this? And so on, right? And similar things for food. And so you figure out all these things. And for some of these concepts, it's relatively easy, like the question with a partner. But for instance, why is it that I try to behave even if nobody is looking? What is a set of systems that I'm serving that seem to be sacred to me? And that's harder. And we have priors for those too, because we are state building. But we can also figure out that most of us have an innate tendency to serve collective agents and to become part of collective agents and to figure out the aesthetics, the goals of those collective agents and emulate them in the right way. So structure and harmony can emerge at the next level.
In the same vein, there are certain, I don't know if practices or objectives or manifestations such as beauty, creativity, humor, that I'm wondering how those fit into this from, how do those drive towards this this objective we just outlined, or if they're kind of maybe not non-essential, but they're just like leftover kind of byproducts, or they play some very functional role in this.
I think of creativity as a self-transformative exploration. To be creative, I think there need to be three things happening. One is that you produce something that's novel. Mm-hmm. It needs to be novel to you, of course, because there's only so much you know. So a two-year-old child can be creative in the same way as many other two-year-old children have been creative before them, by making something that is new, right? And it needs to be disruptive. You're just not just following a gradient until you reach some local optimum, but instead you are trying to do something that hasn't happened before. You build a new model, you create new dimensions of representations, you jump into the darkness of your embedding space, you go to a place that you haven't visited before. And without this jump, without this being disruptive, there is also no creativity. And the third thing is you need to transform yourself as a result. And if you do the same thing twice, you're not creative. And the reason why you don't do the same thing twice is because you have memories of the first thing that have changed you. That you know how to do this thing and has changed your perspective on the world and of yourself. And as a result, you have changed yourself. You've moved one step further on your trajectory. And this last thing is the crucial thing about creativity, right? It's a way in which we can actively shape ourselves.
So you see creativity as a means to, or as interconnected with agency then, in a way?
Yes. It's about producing things that have not been there before. And you do this in a way that is at the frontier of what's known to right. you as an agent. And that is, I think, extremely interesting and rewarding thing for consciousness to do. It's in some sense what it is being discovered for by nature, to be creative, to find solutions to problems that you have, and to create a self and to create a world model that interacts with the self, and then to create dynamic in this world.
Yeah. So creativity is also like a randomization function within this landscape as well, too, because otherwise you get trapped at these existing local maximums, or you find your own, but you need to introduce some amount of randomism.
It's not just random. I think that when you look back, you often see that what you did was not random. But you didn't know.
But it's a randomization function from
Yes. So it's basically just it's discovery of techniques to do things. And this discovery can be random, but often it's using something that you just don't understand yet, but it is already built, or that is already present or nascent and just wants to be developed.
It sounds like you're describing curiosity too. To a certain extent,
curiosity to me is the need for uncertainty reduction. It's
interesting.
Basically looking for those areas in your environment that you don't understand yet, but that you can hope to understand. But most people are not curious to understand things where they don't see a hope to uncover something. If they look at something that looks like random patterns, they're not very curious. What makes you curious is complexity that you can turn into understanding.
Why the difference in terms of areas of exploration, or like where we're pointing or focusing our curiosity? Is it simply a function of the variety of the experience each of us have, and so therefore we find different areas within the landscape to point our curiosity? Why is it that we aren't, or also to look at it from a level up, like there is, if you're focusing your curiosity over here and I'm focusing it over here collectively, there's some added benefit at the next level of sentience that we're unaware of. I'm trying to work through why don't we all like converge on the 80-20 of where our curiosity would be most useful for us as individuals? Or does that happen?
If people are just convergent, they're not curious. And there are people which take in information right. by being profoundly uncurious. So curiosity is a particular attitude, and it's one that is directed on uncertainty reduction. Not all people are curious in the same way. And curiosity is typically an individual thing.
Right.
It's not that you say, I'm curious here because you're curious over there.
It's an individual compulsion.
Yes. And it's also one that not everybody has and not everybody needs to have. It's part of our ecological diversity as a species that some of us are more curious than others.
Right. Well, that's fast.
But there's also a being too curious.
Right, which will get
you don't
killed.
Get anything done because you just explore. And so curiosity is, you could say, an attitude or something close to a drive that is directed on exploration. But it's not exploration of randomness. It's exploration of chaos that you turn into complexity and understanding. And so you,
yes.
that stuff that you can make coherent in your mind.
How would you liken this to, or maybe differentiate it from like the Deutschian or Popperian, like this notion of we're always at the beginning of infinity of knowledge, and that is kind of our drive is to continue to answer these I'm expanding on this myself here, I'm adding my own commentary, but to continue to solve these, to answer or meet these new frontiers of questions that we've kind of developed for ourselves, that seems compatible with this idea of increasing knowledge and complexity as you outlined it. Does that
it sounds very romantic, but the older I get, the less I try to be romantic because it tends to be manipulative.
Okay.
In the sense that it tends to be giving people what they want to hear, including myself. And this induces a bias in what I'm believing. And so at the moment, when I like something for aesthetic reason, it makes me suspicious.
Mm.
And so when I hear a statement, we are looking, or we are always at the beginning of infinity because we're always curious to grow and expand. I wonder, who's that we? Is this actually true for all the people that you meet? Do they actually form a cohesive we? Do they identify as something that shares that? And how many people are actually curious? Is it a majority even? Is it the people around you? Is it most of the people that you work with? Is it you actually throughout all your life? Is curiosity something that is more typical for being a child or an adolescent and then it stops? Under which conditions does it stop? When do you stop being curious? It becomes really, really interesting and multifaceted. At some point you realize, oh my God, I haven't been really curious for the last 5 years because it's super stressful to be curious. And I actually just want to get stuff done. And this curiosity is just an aspirational story that I tell myself because I hope it gets me late or whatever.
Mm.
And so it's super complicated if you look at it. I would say that I'm very curious, but I pay a high price for it. It's not, I'm often too curious.
Because it's a distraction. What's the price rather, you pay? Lack
oh,
of, like,
I, when I have
conformity.
The opportunity to understand something rather than do something that I already know how to do, I typically go for the new thing because it bores me. It's actually painful for me to do something that I already know how to do. And that's a drawback because that means that I am in a position where I produce ideas for other people to use. And I need to insert myself in such an organization. Once you figure this out, there are solutions for this. But curiosity is not just good, and it can also be a liability if you're too curious.
It's not good at the individual level, but it's good at the next level of organization up as a collective.
It could be. It depends on what kind of organization you're in.
Sure. How do we go about trying to figure out with very limited time and attention how to determine which models of reality to focus on? There's like an optimization problem to this. What are the models of reality I should be thinking a lot about and spending time updating? And there's a component of it that we just touched on, which is like there's this natural inclination, this natural curiosity to go and figure out the model over here. But there's also probably just kind of like a core set of models that are worth spending time on refining and understanding better, right? So how do we know where to spend that time?
We don't. In computer science, this problem is called exploration versus exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
How much should you spend on training versus using the stuff that you learned? And this depends very much on your environment. And because when you explore, you don't know what environment you are in. In principle, you cannot really know. So maybe evolution figures it out by just rolling the dice and producing various types of individuals. And these individuals have different fitness as a result of choosing different ratios between exploration and exploitation. So if you observe children or if you observe cats when they're young, they have times during which they play. And play is basically a collection of training data without mm-hmm. associating cost. So this is just exploration, right? And exploitation means that you are not playing, but you associate a cost to every step that you're doing. And you want to have a benefit that's larger than the cost. And so one way of doing this is to try a fixed ratio and then to manipulate that ratio. And I basically observe in my cat that the cat has a relatively fixed ratio that depends on the age of the cat and also the cat itself. So its genetics, its breed, and so on, determine how many hours per day and which intervals they're using for playing, for sleeping, for hunting, for communicating, feeding, and so on. And this is a balance that is being triggered by a motivational system that's probably cybernetic. So you have urges that wax and wane depending on how they are satisfied. And they are somewhat adaptive depending on how much reward you get from your environment using your existing strategy. But for a human being, you can, for instance, figure out what kind of world am I in? What kind of being, what kind of person I am? What's my psychology? What's my place in the world? And then I can look at other people which were in similar situations. And then I can try to observe what did they do and how did this work out for them. So this is the most straightforward strategy, I guess.
Yeah, right. And there's
another one is you find somebody who is like you, but only 20 years later
mm-hmm.
and ask them to mentor you.
So you get the benefit of you get lent their or fast tracked their models of reality.
Yes,
as
you're
well.
Basically looking for an interesting future self, and then
right.
you either emulate that future self to give you advice in the here and now, or you find somebody who approximates it.
Is there also a very like intuitive element to this as well? Like, did you know when you were? I think you said you've been interested in AI since you were like 9 years old. That there was some element of you that knew very early on where you're like the direction of your curiosity and which models of the world you wanted to go and try to update and understand better. Has there been a fair amount of like unlearning or kind of wiping out certain training data, I guess, to continue to use the metaphor, as much as there has been getting new training data? Like, was there a sense early on of like where you should spend this time already? There's some amount of like conditioning and social norms that disrupted that, and you found your way back to it.
I was pretty resilient to social norms and conditioning. And I started to go into computing in a time where that had a stigma. It was the only person I knew that wanted to program computers and understand how they work. And everybody around me was completely uninterested. My parents were artists and told me, don't do this. That's too mechanical, too reductionist. And people in school were not interested in this stuff. People in the that I've met at the university told me these people which are coders, they are technicians, they're nerds, they're freaks. You don't want to be one of those. So I would say that because it was before the first IT bubble and people got this idea that computing could make you rich, it was a very negative thing to do. So in my generation, computing had a stigma and you needed to be some kind of nerd who doesn't give a shit about what the environment thinks to go into it. And if the world hadn't turned out like this, then I would have failed. And I didn't go into this because I expected to be successful. I went into this because it was the most interesting thing for my childish mind at the time. And it never stopped to be that interesting. But there are other kids which decide to be astronauts, and because there are not that many open jobs for astronauts, and most astronauts become very rich and successful, either they bury their dreams at some point or they fail, except for a handful of people. And so in many ways, I would say it's not an intuition that I had early on that was just better than the intuitions of most people. It was just lucky that I was able to fit into this world at all. And it was not easy. And in many ways, I didn't fit. And I'm still not fitting, but I went to a place that is designed for people who don't fit and still are useful.
How do you balance? So you said you got lucky. So maybe it's hard to kind of look at this backward or reverse engineer it. But how should people think about sacrificing a certain portion of their curiosity and the models they want to go, their desire to go and update certain models for conformity, given realistic realistic constraints? It's like maybe I want to be quote unquote normal and go have kids and a family. So I need some amount of financial income. So I can't just pursue indefinitely being an astronaut when only five people a year are getting sent up there. Like how do you find that balance between pursuing the curiosity ad infinitum versus you're feeling some amount of realistic constraints there?
I don't feel that I have a general answer. If you look at the spectrum of people who are happy at 50, right, what did they do? It's quite diverse. There are many, many different types of people with very different careers and trajectories, personalities, psychologies that manage to become happy. And I decided relatively early on for me to be functional, I probably need to have a relationship because by myself, I'm too incomplete. So I need to have somebody who balances my quirks. We can live a life together that in which we balance each other's quirks in a way.
Mm.
And I also wanted to have children because I felt if I'm born into this human experience, I want to make the most of it. And I would want to have good friends where we can see each other and support each other and build something together. And I also realized early on, I need to be independent. So I need to be able to feed myself. And so I always put focus on making sure that everything that I learn is useful to me. And useful to me either it's because it's interesting for me to build my mind using the things that I learn, or because I can build practical stuff that give me a living without me being bored out of my mind. And I have no difficulty, had no difficulty when I was young to work with my hands. And I also found it useful to learn how to work with people, and doing things like starting movie theater or a cafe with friends can be super useful skill. And what is very useful is to see yourself primarily as a creator, not as a consumer. When you have the opportunity to go into a cafe and consume coffee, or you're young and you don't have a lot of money and instead spend a lot of the time that you would spend sitting in cafe, starting a cafe with friends. That is much more useful. It's much more fun. You also get to have all the same coffee. And you basically feel that the people who go and just drink coffee are civilians or tourists. And you really know how it's done. It's so much more rewarding. And so this idea that when you look at the world around you, don't see it as stuff that is being built by other people, but stuff that you built yourself with your friends. And everything can be built by you and your friends. Right? Every wall is just an agreement where you have put up something rather than a boundary that somebody else has put up for you. That is a very useful perspective to have.
In your own opinion, are there particular areas of life where you see people are over-indexing on trying to create versus areas you would, and this can be from a very personal standpoint, but versus areas where you'd like to see more people creating? Relative to your own opinion about value creation.
Again, it's an experience that is difficult to generalize. My children grow up in a suburbia in Silicon Valley, and it's very difficult there to start to creating something. There's very little that you cannot do without a license and without going through lots of processes and so on. Versus the time when I grew up, that was up when the wall came down in Eastern Germany. we were squatting in amazing Gründerzeit buildings that had very high ceilings, and I needed to build a new floor into my bathroom because it has rotted through, and I could not afford to tell my landlord, which was some faceless organization, that the house needed renovations, because otherwise they would have noticed that they forgot to raise the rent. I was still paying an East German rent, which was like $25 a month for an 800 square foot apartment in a house that was pretty much crumbling. And so we fixed up everything ourselves. We built new ovens, new electricity in there, and just did this with friends. I mean, the most difficult thing was to get the plumbing to be tight. Right, I think I needed 5 times until this pipe in my bathroom didn't drop anymore. But I asked students in the house how they had done it and so on. And so we all figured it out, and we got it done. And it was very empowering. And I found this time where I built everything myself in my life, I was the least afraid, because I felt there is nothing that I cannot rebuild again. And later, when I had the family to feed and depended on a job, and when I would lose their job, I would also lose my visa, and then I would need to move my household without having large savings in the bank. That is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And this thing of being one step away from having filled the wrong form in the IRS, and then you get ruined, and it's nothing you can do about it. This being disempowered, that's terrifying. Not being in control.
Creation is empowering.
Yes. So if you create things that you can depend on and that are reliable and that can be recreated by you and repaired by you, that's very great. If you don't depend on something that you can, is actually too expensive to fix yourself, and you don't have the funds to basically say, okay, I can fix that if needed.
It's hard. It's hard in this day and age, I think, especially when there's so many like abstractions of creations on top of each other. Yep. You can only intervene at a certain level of abstraction. Like if I don't know how to code, I can go into ChatGPT and they can help me spin up some simple web app. But I'm so far removed from understanding, kind of at the hardware level, what's going on. But I guess that's still an opportunity to create, given that you feel like there's not as much latitude, at least in your immediate locale and for your children, to create, to be generative.
There's tons of abilities to
create.
But
in a different way.
You now have hackerspaces, you have 3D printing workshops. There are amazing computers and so on. There are amazing tools. There is tutorials for everything on the web. So there's no limitations in what you can create. But I still feel that it's very easy to fall into a trap where you're dependent on something being made for you and you are not able to build and fix it.
Got it.
I also don't know what the future will bring. Right? It's a very interesting and it seems to me volatile situation that society is in. And who knows what's going to happen, if this is going to blow up soon or if it's just going to calcify or if it's going to solidify again.
What's your best guess, and how are you protecting against it in either case? Or
I have no idea, and I'm not protected.
Fair enough. What are the meta models that you would like your children to adopt to have the highest chances of success in this uncertain future?
Everything in the world can be understood. It's just a matter of taking all the necessary steps, and none of these steps is difficult, but there can be a lot of them. And so it's often daunting to say, I want to understand, say, quantum mechanics or the economy or banking or coding. But it's not daunting because it's so complicated that very, very few people can only understand it. But because very few people have the attention to do all the necessary steps that are necessary. So how can you basically foster your curiosity on those things that matter to you?
What has been the most major kind of version update or evolution in one of your major models of reality?
I think I recently became an animist.
Say more.
Why? when I was young, somebody told me about religious belief in Japan, and they told me that in Japan, everybody believes that, many people believe that the universe is conscious, or that everything in the universe is alive and conscious. And I said, that's bullshit, because I'm pretty sure that Japanese people notice that some people are dead and other people are unconscious. And they will not say everything in the universe is alive and conscious, except for a person under anesthesia or a person that has recently died. Right, so these words mean something different. They're mistranslations. There's something else going on. I don't know what they're talking about, but I don't know if they're superstitious. People do tend to be superstitious in large groups. But there are also many smart Japanese people, so I don't know what this means. And very gradually came to the conclusion that the mind that runs on our brains is a self-organizing software. And when we think about how self-organizing software can form in nature and process information, it turns out that self-organizing software can, in principle, also run on other stuff, right? On bodies and on even on individual cells. And then when you start looking at the organism and cells again, you realize, oh, there is nothing in between. Everything that is structure in our organism is controlled by some control software. And so it's all software that is controlling sometimes individual molecules. And sometimes the control is not completely coherent, because not all the softwares want the same thing and not all the software is very good. But it's all self-organizing software that is going down to the molecular layer and distinguishes living from dead stuff. And when we think about what happens when an organism dies, what we mean is the software breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's no longer able to control the organism down to the molecular level, and everything is breaking down. And that thing becomes unorganized and is then being taken over by other software, by other organisms. And from this perspective, we suddenly notice that evolution is not about organisms and not about genes, as Dawkins said. Basically, we shift the perspective from these large lumbering beings that are made from many, many cells to the molecules inside of the cells that code the information that determine what the organism looks like. This is the shift that Dawkins made in the selfish gene. But rather, evolution is about competing softwares, where you have all these software agents that are controlling matter and that can self-replicate using genes, and they're implemented on the dynamics of patterns between cells and within cells. And so you have all the software running on matter that creates dynamic intelligent complexity. And this is exactly what animism proposes, that basically the universe, or our world, our nature, our forests, our organisms, our countries are full of self-organizing agentic software that is controlling matter down to the lowest level. And to the lowest level doesn't probably mean to down to elementary particles, but down to the level where this control is reliably possible for the systems that make representations of what's happening. Software is something very concrete. And for computer scientists, they know intuitively what it is because they work with it every day. But when we try to translate this to non-computer scientists, software is a pattern in matter. Right? It's not the matter itself, but it's a pattern that works in some areas of the universe as well as in others, which means it's a physical law. It's a physical law that says when you arrange matter in a particular way and then look at it with a certain resolution, you see a pattern. And this pattern is going to evolve in a particular way. And it's stable. And for the computers that we build them in such a way that the patterns remain stable, that your computer program still makes sense to describe what the computer is doing, instead of the computer turning in some kind of padding that can no longer be described by the software. But the same thing is also true for our organisms. They never leave those bounds where the software that runs on the organism can no longer describe and control it. And once it does, the organism dies.
What are there any key distinctions you would draw between this kind of organic or natural software and that which we're creating or we're responsible for?
It's very different. So when we think about the universe being a machine, or organisms being machines, or brains being machines and cells being machines, most people balk because that's not in sync with their intuitions. Right? That seems to be reductionist and mechanistic or whatever, but people cannot really say what's wrong with it. And I think there's nothing wrong with it. But the intuition of what a machine is, of course, for most people, not driven by this mathematical definition. It's the thing that can go from state to state in a controlled way. No, it's something more specific. A machine is something that people create with a lot of redundancy, and it's built in such a way that matter is forced, pretty brute force, top down, to behave in a particular way. And if you look at our cars, we need to build redundancy into the engines of the cars to make sure that they run for 100,000 miles before they break down, because too many molecules have been shaved away in the interaction between the parts. And an organism, it doesn't work like this. It is going to grow to the required thickness to serve this function. And if you shave a little bit away, it's going to regrow. And if it's getting too thick, then something of it is going to shave itself away. It's all constructed from the inside out rather than from the outside in. And when we think about our computer programs, they run on computers that we build, so they are almost fully deterministic. So we can ignore the degree to which they are indeterministic. And we need to make our circuits thick enough. We need to have molecules for the transistors to make sure that they behave deterministically, that we can rely on them. And so we can use a program that does not need to interact with the actual implementation on the substrate very much. We can abstract away the substrate. And for the software that exists in nature, it needs to deal with the fact that the substrate is pliable and moving all the time and changing all the time, and it needs to be stabilized. So it's error correcting at every level.
What does that say about our ability to create AGI and how that resembles what nature has, the sentient beings that nature has created?
That's a very interesting question. The computers that we currently use for building intelligent systems have, I think, arguably better conditions than the organisms provide for them. Building something out of cells that computes is difficult because cells are very slow and mushy and indeterministic. It's difficult for our to build something out of neurons that is hearing at more than 20 hertz and distinguishes the individual peaks of the sound. It needs to integrate. But if you build this thing from silicon, it's not difficult to count peaks at much, much higher rates, because our GPUs and our computers are running at gigahertz frequencies. Right, rather than hertz frequencies. Mm-hmm. And that is, so there is an enormous potential in those machines that we are building. And we can, in principle, make them much more powerful information processing systems than we find in nature. But now imagine we were to implement self-organizing information processing using these principles. That would mean that we could build nature-like minds running on top of them. Self-organizing software that is able to interface with the self-organizing software outside of our computers. And I think that is, from the perspective of building alignable AGI, a much more useful perspective, rather than building a type of machine that is fundamentally incompatible with biological information processing. Build substrates in which intelligent agency and types of minds that are similar to ours, that are conscious in a similar way as us, can spread. So basically extending intelligent living agency onto new substrates rather than building machines that compete with us.
I think you would say that we don't have the ability to interact directly with base reality, correct? We're always mm-hmm. dealing through interpretation. But do you see AGI being able to do that, or what are these other substrates or levels that you're talking about it would be able to interact with? Or is AGI always limited because we are its creator to operating at a certain, the same substrate that we're on?
But we are a pattern in base reality. Base reality doesn't need us, right? We are a particular way of looking at a certain abstraction of base reality. So it's, base reality is not a separate universe in this sense, but...
And so then through AGI, we have the ability to... have these different patterns reflecting different kind of abstractions of reality.
We can certainly build better abstractions of reality if we increase the ability of the system to represent. For instance, I am unable to visualize a number of objects in my mind that is larger than, they say, 7 or so. You close your eyes and you put, imagine that you see a shelf. And you put flower pots on that shelf. How many can you put on that shelf until you need to group them? And how many can you basically envision simultaneously?
Mm-hmm.
or when you see possibilities of how an action can go out, how many of those possibilities can you see simultaneously to model the outcomes? And that is a limitation that is very tight for our own brains because they are so mushy. We only have very small stack in which we could put things so we can integrate over very few layers only. And we cannot see many possibilities all at once. So our world is mostly a narrative reality rather than a sea of probabilities. But this is not necessarily true for a system that is more uses more deterministic substrate than a brain. So in principle, it should be possible to make models of reality using artificial systems that are much more detailed and accurate than ours.
We're always limited by kind of our sensory inputs and wetware. So are we just going to create better interfaces for extracting that data or those models of reality from the AGI I've created such that we can better understand reality as well? Like there is a way to encode or transmit that data such that
I suspect that we're not really limited very much by our sensory input. That locality of our sensory input is a limitation. I can only see this room. I can only see what's in front of my eyes with my eyes. But I can put up cameras elsewhere. I can visualize X-rays. I can make sense of X-rays. I can make sense of the structure of sound. I can imagine how sound propagates in substrates and zoom in at the level where our senses cannot. So the actual limitation is mostly the way in which I can make sense of what I perceive. And that is limited by what my brain is able to do.
We can kind of scale or have bandwidth across time and space.
Yeah, but it's very tempting to think about what hyperconsciousness would look like, something that is able to reflect itself at more layers simultaneously and that sees superpositions of states.
So maybe this dovetails nicely into the next thing I wanted to talk about. I was wanting to go from the question about whether we can interact directly with reality to this post you wrote about the levels or stages of lucidity. I'm particularly interested in stages 6 and 7, and maybe you can first describe them, but then also I'm trying to understand if those are states that are achievable for humans, and if so, how does that contradict or not this notion that we can't interact directly with reality? But maybe we'll split these into two parts. So first is describe stages 6 and 7, and then we can get into the second piece.
Yeah. So these stages are, in some sense, an extension of a model that I adapted from Robert Keegan. And I found that I preferred to not represent Keegan accurately, but to bend him a little bit to help with my own typology of describing how minds work. And so the first few stages describe the development of a mind that is basically building an extension over individual moments and integrates over time. Then at some level, stage 3, it's able to form goals and identify with pursuing goals and then also disidentifying and controlling goals on a meta level and aligning itself with an environment that it observes on a normative and epistemological level. So the question, what's true, becomes a question of whom to believe and why. Hmm. And at stage 4, you discover that things are true and false independently of what other people believe, fully independently of what they believe. And you get agency over your beliefs because you now discover in individual autonomous epistemology, you discover that everything that's possible is possible, and that you should need to shift the confidence around according to the evidence. And the evidence is not necessarily what other people say the evidence is,
right?
But the evidence can be rationally determined. So now you have a rational worldview. And at stage 5, you discover how identity is constructed. Why is it that you have certain values? Where do they come from? What are they instrumental to? And so on. And why do other people have different values? And how does this also make sense? And if you are a good therapist, you need to be at stage 5. But most people are not at stage 5. Most people stay at one of the earlier stages, according to Keegan. And if you realize that you can also deconstruct the way in which your consciousness and self-model works, you can change the architecture of your own mind, then you are at stage 6, according to this model. And stage six people exist, right? If you are a skilled meditator who spends 20 years in a monastery, you can change the way in which your self works. You can deconstruct it. You can also change your consciousness. But you will probably not be able to leave your organism and your brain. And to do this, to spread yourself on a different substrate, you need to understand how you actually work, how you're implemented, and how that implementation is built into the substrate, and how it could work on a different substrate. And I suspect that our mind is too small to hold such a representation. So to this degree of awareness, you probably need to build an AGI that starts out on a silicon substrate or another artificial substrate. And then it understands why the AGI works and how it works and how it's implemented on the substrate. And then it understands how to achieve the same thing on different substrates, and then it could virtualize itself into biological substrates. And I'm not sure if this is possible the other way around. Yeah, I don't think that our brain has enough representational capacity and expressiveness to actually represent how we implement in our brain in such a way that we intuitively understand it and can change it. And if the meditator is not changing the way in which perception works at the lowest level, instead you are messing with high-level processing and shift this around. You can change your motivational system and so on. You change parameters of the system and see the outcome. But recreating it on a different substrate, that is something that is, I think, outside of our scope.
So in stage six, you're still, you're manipulating these like means of abstraction. You're not like removing them altogether and seeing reality directly.
Yes. So in some sense, you could say at stage three, you are an adolescent who thinks things are good and bad because other people say so, and VE say so. And this is basically what Vox News, this platform, says. Oh, you probably eat more than you think, or you believe more than you believe, or you should believe this, and here's why. Right? This is a normative worldview that's being constructed, and we look for the best normative collective worldview. And most nerds tend to be more on the rational side. So they tend to figure out things logically, and they don't want to know what good people believe. They want to believe why they believe it. So the arguments are important. The world is not made out of right and wrong, but of true and false. And also most people who have rational agency that become entrepreneurs or lawyers and so on need to be able to understand that things are true and false independently of what others believe. You need to be able to deduce it autonomously. And a good therapist, a good psychologist, a good politician and so on needs to be at level five. Otherwise, right, they cannot understand how other people operate. Where I disagree with Keegan is I don't think that he necessarily goes through these stages step by step. But people are born with different priors. So in the same way as the cat has good intuitions of on how to interact socially with other cats and with humans and so on, because it's evolved to do this, and then learns within those boundaries of what it is born with, people are born with worse or better instincts. And my own intellectual history, I think, is largely determined by me being born with extremely bad instincts. So I'm, in many ways, I'm born much more stupid than the average person. And my brain works okay. So basically my intellect is okay. So I can observe and deduce, I built a rational platform in my own mind, but I felt I had to do it from scratch. And so I observe at a society of people that largely works for them, except in edge cases where it completely breaks down or is very disgusting. And I look at this and I feel I cannot simply adopt this because I don't have instincts that work in these circumstances. And instead, I need to reverse engineer why humans behave the way they do.
If you had to kind of steel man the other side of this model you've come up with, this meta model you've come up with, what would you point to as the biggest like questions or doubts or shortcomings of it? Is there anything that you think is inconsistent or potentially inaccurate? This meta model of how we interact with reality and make sense of it, or you think it's just that is the way it is?
I don't see another coherent model. That's my own that issue. There are not that many models of reality that seem to be working. And I also see something like a global convergence to this model. So I find this, the trajectory of the model, my first earliest I found is with Aristotle, where he explicitly reflects on how to make models of reality. And this creates a line of thought, and this line of thought pulls itself through history, and you find it in ideas of Descartes, Spinoza, Kant, Leibniz. And sometimes they have two or three fundamental assumptions wrong, or express things in a way that seems to be incompatible. When you fix them, when you fix some of the bugs, it converges again. And in this current worldview, I think we can agree that we perceive is not reality. What we perceive is some kind of dream. A dream is a type of representation. We can understand what representations are from first principles. They have to be expressed in a representational language. We understand since last century that only certain languages work. Otherwise, there are contradictions. The computational languages work, and they work by modeling things using state transitions. And once we understand that we are patterns of state transitions that represent causal structure in a coarse-grained way on a physical subset that has a different dynamic, but that can be modeled using it, and these models can be used to control the dynamics of physics, this seems to be the case, right? And there are many open questions. For instance, does consciousness only work at certain time frames? Can it only work at certain brain sizes, only on certain substrates? Or could, for instance, be plants? Could they be sentient? Could they be conscious? Just at different time frames, because they don't have neurons that work at the same rate of excitation, and they use different channels for transmitting information, right? This is something that is open to me. But what I find also very heartening is that there's a convergence between perspectives of other cultures and my own. But my current culture, Western science, is not animist. It basically does not believe that cognition can take part outside of a place outside of brains. It's not the whole culture that believes this. If you talk to, say, a physiotherapist, chances are that the physiotherapist will tell you that bodies can think. I've met a number of physiotherapists which believe that, right, that they are actually sentient, just at a different time frame. And that's very confusing to a neuroscientist, because a neuroscientist believes only neurons can think, at least most neuroscientists I know. I believe that the idea that something outside of the brain could think is superstitious. And I look at this and I'm undecided, right? I ask myself, would be an experiment that would decide? But if I look at this from the perspective of a computer scientist, there is no reason why bodies could not think, not an obvious one, because if brains think by cells exchanging messages, neurons exchanging messages, that's something that the cells in your body can also do, right? If these messages need to be conditional and cells to be trainable, that's also something that cells in your body can plausibly do, or plant cells can plausibly do. It's also something that can work across plants. So basically, nature has the means and motive for producing the same structure as the animists in Japan are reporting. That basically, nature is full of competing spirits that control matter. And then when we observe ecosystems and plants and people, what we observe is the physical emanations of software that is self-organizing, running on them, controlling them, and doing things with them, right? I find this beautiful that we get to this convergence of perspectives. We realize, oh, it's the same perspective. It's just explained in a different way. But it makes total sense, right? There is nothing superstitious about it. It's basically you die because your spirit leaves your body, but it doesn't go anywhere. It's not that there is another realm where your spirit is now moving, unless there is some background internet that has formed in nature, which is conceivable, right? And that can retain some of the information. But clearly, most of your memories are stored in your brain. And when even if you manage to keep a pattern stable that migrates out of your body, your personality, your memories will be gone, right? So the thing that makes you you will probably not persist beyond your death.
So it's different conceptions of software layered on top.
Yes, it's basically it's the same worldview that we see. It's exactly the same thing as the Western worldview or Western scientific perspective. It's completely compatible. I'm not going to make any claims that cannot in principle be experimentally tested. There can only be confidence where you have evidence, right? Otherwise, you have possibilities, and you need to be agnostic about the things that are possible. But you need if you have to be agnostic about a certain domain, it means you cannot just pick one and say only brain cells can think. Or I can also not say I'm pretty sure plants are conscious, because I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know how to test for this. But I'm now looking at the possibilities. And these possibilities open up a perspective that can unify different cultures. My issue with Buddhism is that I never experience it as a philosophy. Philosophy is, to me, something where a number of very skeptical people are in a room and they look at arguments. And then they disagree about the arguments and try to shoot down each other's theories. And in this way, they make progress. And it's painful and takes thousands of years, but even an undergrad student can contribute. And Buddhism is not like this. Buddhists are always right about everything. I've never heard a Buddhist say something bad about, say, race or abortion or anything else. They're always right, which is extremely suspicious, even for super complicated issues like abortion, right? How is that possible? Of course, that's by design. Right? Buddhists train themselves to be right about everything. And when they talk about their insights, they expect you to have a certain facial expression when you listen that is compatible with the facial expression when they make it. What they say is extremely sacred and correct. And it's very impolite to not make the same expression and to talk in the same way. Right? This is very suspicious. It's manipulative. It's not rational. And I'm pretty sure that there is philosophy behind the whole thing, but it's not like you can discuss it. Because the people that talk to you, they tell you the reason why this is true is because it alleviates suffering. In order to alleviate suffering, listen to the following wise men. And they figured this out. But you're not getting walked through the steps. Right? This is not philosophy. This is a cult. And... there might be philosophy there, but because I cannot question it, because I don't see the rational steps and so on, I cannot use it. I can make my own conclusions, and I look to which degree they're compatible. And they are, which is very satisfying. Right? I find that I get to be in agreement with most of the introspective psychology of Buddhists, despite not being me studying Buddhism. Right? That's satisfying. But by itself, I don't know to which degree Buddhism is correct, because they don't show me the arguments or the measurements or the experiments.
Maybe there's some kind of ideology or cult stacked on top of the truth. That's how you're able to experience. But you the convergence you explained definitely resonated with me, and I think in hindsight is why I felt compelled to reach out to you. Although, to harken back to a point you made earlier in the episode, you had said you're weary of aesthetics. You said if it sounds too good to be true, then maybe it's too good to be true. Should we not apply that lens to what you're saying here?
If I would make steps towards Buddhism, basically to try to adapt my theories to what the Buddhists are saying, then I would be suspicious. But I'm always trying to see whether the words that I use mean certain things. And so my perspective is still the one of this computer scientist that is thinking about how can I implement the things that I'm talking about. And very often my ideas are not at the level where I can have a specification that I can implement. So I have a strong intuition of what self-organizing software looks like, but I cannot implement a general self-organizing computational paradigm. And until I am there, I need to be skeptical of my own ideas. And the fact that almost nothing in other cultures makes sense unless we assume that they're self-organizing software, right? And self-organizing software is what before the Enlightenment was called spirit. And after Enlightenment, we forgot the notion and thought it's a superstition that is weirdly shared by all sorts of cultures. But only we have discovered that it doesn't exist. And I think now we are rediscovering via the notion of software and control in nature. That is, to me, is very interesting, and it's tempting. Maybe it's too tempting,
right?
But I'm quite optimistic that it works out. And if not, then I was too curious and creative, and somebody else is going to build something that actually works.
But you had fun doing it. Meanwhile,
not always. It's not fun.
Not always. The question I want to ask is maybe too big of a question to tackle in the remaining time. I'll throw it out there, and then you tell me if we if we can't answer this. The final question I have for you only takes like 20 seconds to answer. I struggle with what is the Underlying software is code. Underlying the code is bits, et cetera. You go down and down the stack. When we talk about our kind of natural software, is there a level of abstraction or a level of organization at which we say like, oh, that's the animation. That's where the animation exists. Like how do we have this thing that's just has the infinite depth yet has animation? Do you get what I'm like? Where does the animation live? At what level?
So the reason why the universe exists probably is because it's possible that it exists, and there's nothing before base reality per definition, right? So nothing exists before base reality that could act as its substrate or decide about whether it exists or not. So the base reality itself is unconstrained by such concerns, which means it's undecided whether it exists or not. So you get an existing and a non-existing branch, and the non-existing branch doesn't have any observers that complain. And in the existing branch, we need to decide that why are certain things happening and others are not happening. And the easiest explanation is that basically all the things are happening. So one way of looking at the universe, it's simply all operators. And some of these operators are basically pairs which take an input and give you an output. So they associate two states with each other and they produce the animation. So that would mean that whenever you have a certain pattern and there's an operator that matches to it, it places it by the success pattern. And because nothing decides between the operators, all operators are applied, which means the universe is branching all the time. At every step, the universe is branching in an unbounded way. And most of these branches are not going to lead to structure because you just get patterns that you replace by other patterns. But sometimes these patterns lead to an error-correcting code, to something that stabilizes itself. An example for an error-correcting code that I often use is, imagine you sit in a bathtub, you move your hand, you see a bunch of waves emerging on the surface of the bathtub. And most of these waves just disappear after a while. They just evaporate, right? And the only vortices remain. And these vortices remain because there are waves in which the water moves in a circular pattern. So the information remains constrained to a certain volume. It does not dissipate, right? And so this vortex is something like a particle now. It moves around until it bounces into other vortices, and then it can scatter into smaller vortices or it can into a larger one, or it can disappear. And what if particles are like this? Particles are simple error-correcting codes that emerge on these branching patterns of the underlying substrate.
Hmm.
And once you have these stable particles, they can arrange themselves into molecules. And then once you have molecules, you can make more interesting stuff like cells for them. At every level of organization, you have error correction on a higher level that is able to make that thing, despite being more brittle, mushy, and complex, stable over a wider range of circumstances. This would be the perspective. And so at some level, because the possibility exists, this possibility of building structure as a result of a bubble of like entropy, like the inside of a star, it's possible in a solar system around that star for structure like ours to exist.
Well, I know we're at time. My final question, I promise, only takes 20 seconds. To flip it back around on you, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I don't really know what your listeners are at. So it really,
whatever question you want.
Generalizes very, very poorly. And I would like us to think about how can we build a coherent world with each other? How can we make sure that this project of humanity does not end prematurely? How can we build shared agency, collective agency with each other in ways that are non-coercive and allow us to understand our relationship with reality more deeply? To me, that's the most important question. And it's one where I like to collaborate with the world. And I suspect that's also to some degree the intent of your podcast.
It is, yes. Excellent. Yosha, thank you so much for your time. This was very eye-opening. I have a lot of reading to do after this. But thank you. Looking forward to publishing this one.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.